Sit in a comfortable posture. Do I have to? Can you hear all right at the back there? Or
yeah.
I have some bad karma with high tech. So if you can't hear me properly, just raise your hand in the middle of it, and I'll try and use it. Okay. So just some basic orientation for this weekend. I understand the theme is going beyond suffering. Is anybody interested? I never know how much the theme really matters for people. So, but since this is the theme, I guess I can work around it. Since really the going beyond suffering is really the fundamental purpose of the Buddha's teachings. So really it's about Buddhism. I guess it's kind of a euphemistic way of talking about Buddhism, which is a bit more subjective, the experience of suffering, a bit more subjective approach. And fundamental to it, of course, is actually practice. It's helpful sometimes and even beneficial, of course, to know something about the theory, about the direction move-in in our practice and in our understanding. But most important is that we actually do the practice and have direct experience. So, for example, something like suffering, I mean, it's actually a translation of a Pali word, which has quite a rich diversity of meaning. In the Pali language, this word is dukkha. And in a practical sense, I guess you say a bit more direct way, it is maybe suffering. Unfortunately, it can also bring up in people's minds unpleasant experiences, maybe some resistance, and or at least preconceptions about suffering. We all probably have some experience of it. But the Buddha's approach is to try and allow us a way to investigate this, because it is so fundamental to our experience. And just by human nature, most of us are trying to avoid it. And yet it is the fundamental issue, an existential issue in our life. You can say in one direct way, the whole issue of suffering is really about a simple way of talking about the human condition. If I explain suffering just as a feeling tone, as I mentioned, it has different meanings in different contexts, the word suffering or dukkha in the Pali. And most frequently it's used in terms of a feeling tone. And if we just keep it at that level at first, you can recognize that unpleasant feeling, maybe it doesn't have to be suffering, and it's, you know, kind of extreme sense, but just unpleasant feeling tones. You recognize that they're quite fundamental to our way of relating to life. Very, very simply, you can say human beings, the purpose or what motivates human beings is trying to get away from unpleasant feelings and trying to sustain pleasant feelings. And if you can investigate that deeper, you can just see how much that actually influences our main motivation in life. Our whole life is revolving around this. Some of it is just very instinctual. I mean, if you have some physical pain, well, we recoil from it, don't we? Unless you're a masochist, maybe. Let's keep it simple. Huh? I mean, human beings can be complicated, but let's keep it simple. And this is it's at a physical level, it's at an emotional level, it's at a mental level, it's at an existential level too. And probably more, the existential level is probably the very reason why you come to a retreat in the first place, even though it may be hard to recognize or hard even to acknowledge, but probably we recognize there is some incompleteness. That's when this word dukkha now shifts in meaning from a direct, say, subjective feeling tone to more of an existential issue, that our life is imperfect. And suffering or pain is just a symptom of that. But if we can change our attitude, and this is really what the Buddha is pointing at, change our attitude, we have a different relationship to suffering. I don't want to disappoint you so early in the retreat, but going beyond suffering, I'm not going to pass out the Panadol. You know? It doesn't mean I'm going to take away your suffering. It's going beyond it, which really is to do with our attitude, our relationship with suffering. That's what the Buddha can give us. We can have that experience through the Buddha's teachings. So on a very simple level, you can say there's two kinds of suffering. There's just kind of basic suffering, and then there is extra suffering, compounded suffering. You know, for example, there is the sensations in the body right now. It's quite warm, isn't it? Yeah. The body's a little bit uncomfortable. But then there is the extra suffering we can add to that by wanting it different, by refusing to acknowledge it, by refusing to open to it, by refusing to receive that. So we can build all kinds of stories around that, all kinds of complications, when all it is a changing temperature, a climatic condition which we have no control over, actually, do we? I mean, I guess we could go outside and be a bit cooler, but You know, it's not that much cooler outside. But what we can do with our mind, though, is we can change our attitude and have a different relationship to it. That is possible. We can't change the weather. I mean, okay, we can change, you know, we can work on climate change, right? We can alleviate climate change, can't we? You know, but probably doesn't have that much effect in the short term anyway. But what we can do is change our attitude to it. We can have a bit more of an open, receptive attitude. This is the way it is right now. It's not going to be this way forever, but this is the way it is right now. And we can have a little bit more relaxed, friendly, a little bit less kind of confrontational attitude to it, and it can change. You know, it's uncomfortable, so what? If I look at my life, well, that's a long story. Uncomfortable. But we can have the theory about it, but as I mentioned already, it's a lot of these attitudes are very, very fundamental to our way of relating to life, and we've been actually developing them, or responses, our reactions, all through life. How we relate to suffering, unpleasant feeling, dis-ease, we fill in the blanks, all the whole range of our own personal experiences of suffering. And we're really pointing towards a different way of relating to it, rather than trying to get rid of it completely. The Buddha himself had suffering, if you like, in a certain sense. The Buddha got old and he got sick and he died, just like all of us. But because of his awakened state of mind, it wasn't a big problem. You know, the Buddha died, it wasn't a problem. I don't know if we can say the same thing about ourselves. Huh? Yeah, well, I think it might be. I don't know myself either. I better be careful. When death comes along, I don't know if it'll be a problem or not. Hopefully, be less of a problem anyway. But through the practice of the Buddha's teachings, we can actually change our consciousness, change our attitude. We can actually, at a very simple level, again, from an attitude of denial or not being receptive to this fundamental experience of life, we can change it around that we can be a little bit more open to it, we can be a little bit more understanding of it, and then the experience, personal experience, can be we were more patient with it, and it can even be a source, a gateway to awakening, full awakening. And because we don't like suffering, we're not receptive to it, so we get caught in denying it and ignoring it. It's through ignorance that we are not awakened. And this ignorance is ignoring the facts of life. One of the ultimate facts of life, the fundamental facts of life, is suffering. It's there all the time. It's a natural experience. Having a sentient body, we're going to have some suffering. So instead of increasing our attitude of ignorance, ignoring this fundamental reality of life, we can open to it. And this is the path to awakening then. We're waking up to the truth rather than compounding our ignorance. Of course, always easier said than done, especially when it comes to something so fundamental as suffering. But fortunately, the Buddha has given us these spiritual exercises, most particularly meditation exercises, practice of concentration, practice of mindfulness, so to be able to actually have some possible experience of going beyond suffering, it could be very helpful to develop some of these meditation exercises. Unfortunately, the time is quite short this weekend, but at least we can have some initial experience. And the first meditation exercise is most generally helpful, is to be able to focus on a meditation object. Be able to develop a focused attention. This gives us some stability of mind, and it also allows a certain stepping away from our reactivity, particularly in regard to suffering. For most of us, when suffering comes along, we just get into our automatic reactive syndrome mode. It's automatic, we don't even notice it. You know, when there is a mosquito bite or something, we just get into our reactive mode and bring up the old stories. But if we have a bit of a focused attention, some collectedness of mind, this can calm down this reactiveness, that our attention is more settled on a meditation object like breathing. And then, partly because we're not observing, we're not actually attending to the other reactiveness and the mental activity, it doesn't get triggered. It doesn't get activated. And at the very least, it doesn't get compounded further and further, the old habit tendencies. So I understand there are experienced meditators, maybe even a few professionals. I know they're modest, they won't put their hands up. And there are some beginners, or some people quite new to meditation. So I'll give some meditation instructions over this time. And basically, because each individual, if you like, is at a different stage of practice, just try and follow the instructions, try and apply them as best you can. And more important, to actually get some initial experience rather than try and attain some ultimate state. You know, so I mentioned about, say, focusing your attention on the breathing. It's not really so important how successful you are, but to actually just try and apply this practice, apply this exercise, and just see what happens. And generally speaking, you know, it is helpful to have some continuity and some support, put some time and energy into it. But everybody's a bit different. Some people maybe have quite a bit of talent already at concentration exercises. Some people, maybe they have to really work at it. But we have to know for ourselves, you know, how much effort to put into it. Sometimes if we try too hard, it even trips us up. I've met many Westerners, and particularly in Thailand, for example, who came to Thailand to learn meditation. And most of us, when we went there, with quite a bit of ambition. You know, traveling halfway around the world to learn meditation, and we want to get it right away. We want to get it very quickly, especially since our visa is expiring. I went to Thailand just for 1 month. I thought I could go there for 1 month and have my enlightenment experience and then continue my travels. But I think some other forces may have had something else in mind for me. Because it took me 3 weeks to find a meditation monastery. You know, so already then I had to renew my visa again. So then I had 5 weeks left. Unfortunately, still wasn't enough time. So I ended up staying 9 years. And still wasn't enough time. Still working on it. But at least I had an opportunity to get a good start. And unfortunately, in the beginning, I didn't have a meditation teacher. Because I'd read the books, I'd studied Buddhist teachings. I studied at university under my religious studies course, and I passed the exam, so I thought I knew all about it. And I also had some experience of meditation retreat in Sri Lanka, so I thought I don't need a teacher. I just need a place to stay, a quiet place and a supportive environment, and I just need to have time to practice. But I realize now, after being there and practicing for some time, that I had a very narrow understanding of meditation. I thought it was just concentration. And I forgot actually about the wisdom part. In the Buddhist teaching of the Eightfold Path, for example, sometimes the Eightfold Path is explained in three different categories. Wisdom or understanding at first. Maybe understanding is better in the beginning. Then behavior, right behavior or morality, and then meditation. But since I didn't know much about meditation, I mean, I'd been at a university and studied Buddhism, so I had the understanding already, I thought, at least enough. And then morality, well, that's not so important anyway. You know. But meditation was the part which really fascinated me. So, but there was no opportunity in Canada, you know, 40 years ago, so I had to go to Asia. So when I got there, of course, I was desperate for meditation. And so I thought that I just had to sit there in a quiet place and watch the breath for, well, not too long, you know, a month maybe. And then I have my revelation, my but I realized I had a very, very narrow view of meditation. So in the Buddhist teaching with the Eightfold Path, I mean, the very first factor is right view. And right view is understanding the Four Noble Truths, which is suffering, the cause, cessation, and the path. Of course, I mean, I must admit I didn't really have much of a interest in studying suffering. I wanted bliss. So I just thought, well, I just sit there, watch my breath, and I get blissed out, and then, I don't know, get some epiphany somewhere, sometime, and then it's all over. Well, that was not quite so easy, I'm afraid. But the exercises, the fundamental exercises in focusing attention on the breathing, they do provide a very good foundation. I mean, I should say at the beginning that it's not absolutely necessary, and that each person has a different ability and maybe even a different need for a certain level of calm or concentration or collectedness, stillness of mind. Some people, if they have a talent for it, it can actually be a disadvantage because they can easily get into it and it's no work for them. And then they get a little bit addicted to it, they get a bit attracted to it, and then they don't develop. They just stay there. When I was in when I became a novice in Thailand, I had to go to a meditation monastery to receive the ordination as a novice. And there was another man with me. Well, he was there already. We met at this monastery. And this man had done meditation before in Germany. But he had done a meditation technique which was mainly just concentration. And at this meditation center, it was actually Vipassana meditation center. But he didn't know the difference between Vipassana and Samatha, or calm meditation. So when after we ordained, I went back to a forest monastery and he stayed in the meditation center. And so the teacher was trying to teach him about Vipassana or insight meditation. And this man already had his fixed ideas from his experience of calm meditation. He actually had a mantra he would recite, not the breathing, just using a mantra and get his mind very calm. And he was quite good at it because he had the interest to do it, and maybe coming from Germany, he had quite a lot of willpower. So the teacher got a little bit frustrated with him because he couldn't quite understand what insight meditation is. So in this monastery, there was this novice, young Thai novice, and he was, for myself and also for the other man, he was known as kind of the naughty novice. Because he used to go around and we'd be meditating in our hut. He'd come along and knock on the door and wake us up or disturb us. And he'd be throwing rocks at the dogs in the monastery. And kind of a typical teenager, I guess. I don't know. So one day the teacher said to this German man, he said, "Oh, come into the meditation hall. A lesson for you." So he came in there to sit. And then he invited this novice in to come and sit. And the German man was a bit surprised, What's he inviting him into the meditation hall for? He's so distracted and so restless. But he invited him in and told him to sit down. And the teacher just turned to the novice and he told him, can you meditate? The novice sat down there, crossed his legs, and sat there and boom. And the teacher lifted up his arm and he got out a needle and put a needle in his hand. Nothing. He just sat there, just totally still. He put his hand down, and then he said, "Okay." He said, "Now come out of meditation." So then he came out, started throwing rocks at the dog again. The teacher said, "Concentration, no wisdom." And apparently, this novice, since he was a young child, he could just sit down and just go off into these deep states of concentration. But it was like kind of a catatonic state. He just wasn't there. He wasn't present. He didn't have any awareness. He was deeply concentrated. So his parents didn't know what to do with him, so sent him to the monastery. do you do with somebody who can just sit there like a rock, like a Buddha statue? I mean, so the German man was very impressed, very impressed. That was concentration, but no wisdom, no insight. So, I mean, on the other hand, the Buddha did emphasize the value of concentration. It was a good foundation for developing awareness and insight. So it's a very fine line between developing concentration and knowing when to back off or how much is enough. When I was in Thailand, and after my fifth rains, I had a chance to go wandering. In our tradition, we go leave the monastery and take our robes and our bowl and just wander around in the countryside. And I mean, it's not just going for a holiday, really. One is getting out of the monastery, but the second one is to try and test ourselves, because in the monastery, everything is quite organized and controlled. And there's bells to ring to tell you when to sit and when to walk and all this. So when you leave the sheltered monastery environment, it's quite a test to see how much stamina or how much continuity you have in your practice, how you can keep your practice going in a great variety of situations. It's also a chance to possibly, if you can speak Thai well enough, to go and visit different meditation teachers. So that's what I did. I went out and visited quite a few different teachers, and I had kind of a standard question I asked them. It was, how much concentration do we need? Because it's still a bit of a controversial topic in the Buddhist circles, and even, I guess, all through the history of Buddhism, it's been a bit controversial. And some of the teachers say, well, you need the fourth absorption at least, you know, very, very deep fourth absorption before you can even start insight meditation. And others say, well, maybe just the first absorption is enough. And some say you don't need any really deep concentration. You just use momentary concentration, which arises from the practice of awareness or mindfulness. So it's a little bit, you know, each teacher has their own preference. And so I asked various teachers, and most of them talked about the fourth absorption, which maybe in those days, for some of these Thai teachers, most of them coming from the countryside, probably was not that difficult. Yeah, they had quite a simple lifestyle, and many of them already were, you could say, quite spiritually evolved. They grew up in a Buddhist culture, maybe for many lifetimes, so maybe concentration wasn't so difficult for them. But in the modern day and age, maybe it's not quite so easy these days. So I asked the various teachers. Most of them emphasize quite a bit of concentration. And then when I returned to Ajahn Chah's monastery, I asked him. And he just said, calm enough. I said, yeah, what's enough? You know, especially since I studied engineering, so I wanted a number, you know. First jhana, second, third, fourth, you know, give me a number. He just said, just enough. And I was a little bit disappointed, because that, you know, what's enough? I mean, it's pretty vague, isn't it? But it took me a while before I realized the wisdom of that particular teaching. Because not only does it keep in mind with that, calm enough for insight. You know, calm is not an end in itself. It's calm enough for insight. So it's an open-ended answer, if you like. And each person is different. You got to find out for yourself how much is enough. Not only is each person different, but each time we practice is different too. Sometimes you take up the sitting posture, and if you bring awareness to your state of mind, it's calm enough already. You don't need to just automatically go into focusing on breathing, and more focusing on breathing, and deeper focusing on breathing. Your mind is calm enough already. So you need to be quite aware, quite vigilant about not only your own state of mind, but your own state of mind in different situations. And always keeping in mind the perspective is calm enough for insight. Insight is the way that the Buddha realized will lead to awakening, not calm meditation. The Buddha actually kind of took over the calm meditation, the practice of concentration, from the Brahmanic tradition in India at that time. He practiced it to a very, very advanced degree. to the cessation of perception and feeling, which probably most of us will never even, can hardly even imagine. Can you imagine? Cessation of perception and feeling? Maybe it's catatonia. But he still was awake. He still was aware somehow. But his experience was it's not enough. It's a very, very evolved, very, very advanced state of meditation and mental development in a certain part of our mind. But it's not enough. It's not the way that leads to awakening. And that's when the Buddha discovered insight meditation, contemplation. However, it is within that context. This investigation, this contemplation is within the context of calm enough mind too. It's not just conceptualizing or intellectual discussion or analyzing. It's an investigation from a calm enough mind. One needs to know for oneself just what is that right amount then. But in most of the teachings, there is reference to calm as a very good foundation, a good basis. And especially in this particular situation, if we really are somewhat serious about investigating suffering, then calm meditation is especially helpful, because if the mind isn't calm enough, if you turn your attention to suffering, you can very easily get spun off into the old stories about it and the old reaction patterns again. We have a long history with suffering, even just this lifetime, enough. So it's so deeply ingrained in us, and so you can even say instinctual, that if the mind isn't calm enough, it can easily be pushed off into its old reactive patterns again. And you could even, at the extreme, I would say, you could even reactivate those old traumatic experiences of suffering then. You just get reinforcing them again, reactivating them. But if you are able to experience some degree of calm, and especially have a good relationship with your meditation object, if you find the emotional reaction to something like suffering beginning to get much more energized, you go back to the breathing, back to the breathing, back to the breathing. And you stay with a calm center, a calm point of reference, then you can step out of it, back to the non-reactivity in our mind again. Just trying to jump into it and try and sort it out is not a very effective and not a very useful way. It can be just, again, relating to it in the same old habitual patterns and same old habitual way. This is a fairly short retreat, just a few days. So be helpful at least to start off with the exercises and focusing attention on the meditation object. Generally, breathing is the most universal one. So if this is a very common meditation object, and I think for most people, it's probably most suitable. There are a great variety of meditation objects we could use, but sometimes if they're too specialized, then it's hard to use them in a much more wider context. The benefit of focusing on breathing is we're breathing all the time, through our whole life. As long as we're alive, we're breathing. That's a good thing to be aware of. See? When you stop breathing, you know that's the end. Also, if you can develop more awareness of the breathing process, you have a real appreciation of breathing in the present moment. It can help you to be in the present moment much more often. So this is a little bit of an exercise that would be useful to try and develop. And as I mentioned, everybody has their own, I say, abilities or talents. Important that we don't get too caught up with just trying to attain some particular goal. What is more useful is that we take this focusing of attention on a meditation object as a point of reference and just see how we relate to it. Sometimes if we are using this object of focusing on breathing, if we just get a bit too obsessed with it or too focused on it, actually the mind can get too closed in and too cramped. And it's not a real finely balanced or very harmonious type of concentration then. It's too forced. Your mind can get very, very narrow-mindedness about it. Concentration is a narrowing of the mind, but there should also be some flexibility in that. an ability to also be able to move between the focusing and the expansion, so not to get too obsessed with it. So I say, for example, with the initial exercises, we just take the sensation of natural breathing as the primary or main focus for attention. That means not necessarily the exclusive focus for attention, just the main one. I tried for years to just focus on the breathing, and sometimes I could focus on the breathing, but I just got a headache too. Too much willpower. And the other side of it is that if we do experience focused attention on the breathing with that kind of concentration, then not only can it easily go off it, but when it does, you get incredibly depressed. You know, it's like having an on or off switch, you see, rather than having a dimmer switch, if you like. If you practice with focusing on breathing just as the main or primary one, not the exclusive one, you have a little bit more flexibility now. And so you can actually use it in a really narrow, focused way or expansive way. And the expansive way was more helpful for insight meditation. Be able to expand the awareness just from the breathing, say, to other sensations in the body and feeling tones and states of mind. So if we start off with too much of a narrow focus, we'll have a disadvantage in the longer term of the practice. Certainly, I could accept that maybe you can get some quick results with a very willful and a very energized focusing of attention. You can get some quick results, but you also get some quick losses too. You can get concentrated, and then it can go very quickly because it's too forced, it's too artificial. We have a little bit more of a flexible attitude. It may take longer, but you have a natural concentration then. You can say in one sense that the quiet mind, the focused mind, is a natural state of mind. We've just filled it up with our self-interest, and then we got scattered. We take all that self-interest as the object of attention, and we get scattered in it. And all that's artificial. The silence of the mind is more our natural state. So when we start off with the exercise, it's helpful to have a right attitude to begin with, too. And depending upon people's experience and their own abilities, we just see, you know, just see what happens. And some people may be able to have an experience of calmness of mind, noticeable calmness of mind. I think just being in a quiet place like this, a natural place, we can experience some calmness of mind, right? You've turned off your mobile phones, right? And even your texting services. It's probably just disengaging from that probably is a probably good foundation for calmness of mind. You can forget about it. Nobody can contact you. So in the exercises, the first stage of practice, if you like, is to try to establish some degree of focused attention, some degree of calmness of mind. So for this, the rest of the evening, if you want to continue with the practice, and tomorrow morning, you can follow those exercises to begin with. And generally in a meditation retreat, I try to explain it in the context where we start off with some simple exercises and try and get a bit more stability in these basic exercises first, and then I bring in other exercises that we can begin to expand our repertoire of meditation practices. But important that we actually have some good experience of even the basic ones. Even if for this whole weekend all you do is focus on breathing, that's very, very important. Because if we haven't got a good foundation, then it doesn't matter how much we hear or how much we try and learn afterwards, it's just going into our busy mind. So it just becomes more information. Or if you have some degree of calmness of mind, you're hearing things at a different level of consciousness. It goes much deeper. Ajahn Chah used to remind us when we listened to a talk, he says to listen with your heart. Yeah. Your ears are open already, but try and listen from here. And then you see what actually has meaning for you, what has value for you. And when I reflected upon the times I heard him give teachings, you know, most of the time he didn't actually give a great variety of teachings. But it was really important the state of mind you were in, how receptive you were. And I remember sometimes being in a, you know, occasionally being somewhat of a receptive state. And I heard him say something which my ears had heard many times. And then, that's what he means. In the Thai language, to understand means literally to enter the heart. And the Westerners say, it entered, I understand up here. And the Thais would say, no, that means you don't understand. You've got the information up here, but it hasn't really entered your heart. It hasn't really understood it. So when we can actually experience some degree of calm, you can actually, in a sense, you can actually have an experience of sort of an openness of heart, an openness of mind. Your defenses, your self-defenses kind of fall away, and you're not just thinking about it or processing it or like analyzing it. You know, normally we're hearing things and a little voice in the background saying, oh, that's good, that's not so good, that's stupid, this is intelligent. You notice that? Or this is the advanced class, right? You're hearing from you're listening from the quiet mind, so it's just coming right in. You're understanding deeply. So it's really about the quality of our learning, the quality of our mind, rather than the quantity. Yeah. And because there is a variety of people with different experiences here, I usually kind of give a bit of a broad overview of various exercises and teachings, and hopefully it's useful for somebody. But it's really important is the quality of our attentiveness, the quality of our consciousness. Right? You don't have to hear you don't have to understand everything. You know, your ears are open, so the information is going in, and if it's really meaningful, it'll enter. You'll have this kind of more like aha experience. So that's what that means, rather than just more information to process. So as an initial exercise in the meditation practices, can be helpful to give some energy and put some attention into focusing on the breathing. We just use the breathing as a main focus for attention. If your mind is wandering away or distracted, gently, patiently bring your attention back to breathing again. And I would emphasize more the continuity of that rather than the forcefulness of it. You know, I lived in Switzerland for 17 years, mostly teaching Swiss and German people. And so I really realized the value of this gentle and patient attitude, because a lot of people there have quite a bit of a willpower, and so they usually come to meditation with the willpower, which has its place, but it's also quite limited. And if we can have some continuity in the practice, keep doing it with a more peaceful and gentle attitude, we actually change the wandering habits of mind, rather than just kind of superimpose some calm on the mind, our natural mind, for a temporary retreat situation. If we have some continuity with it, we begin to actually change those wandering habits of mind. You know, it's a bit like teaching children. You know, I have children, but you know, if you're just going to shout at the child, don't do that once, well, okay, they get frightened for a while, but then they're back to it again. But if you keep up with it, keep up some continuity, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that, you know, for 20 years or so, then they might learn. But if you just say it once with a bit of willpower, then maybe that usually doesn't have much effect, much long-term effect. See? So likewise with our mind, it's a bit like that. It's also, if we keep up with the practice, with emphasizing more continuity, consistency, persistence, patience, these simple qualities, then you may notice, can't say when, but you may notice that sometime your mind just gets in the habit of settling on the breath, rather than its normal habit being scattered and wandering, and every once in a while you can grab a hold of it and force it to sit there and force it to be quiet. which we usually can't sustain because it takes too much effort, and it's actually working against the natural tendency of the mind. I find after all these years, now I talk about learning to work with the mind, work with our tendencies, with our habits, rather than against them. Trying to work against them is hard work and usually doesn't have long-lasting effects. So we need to be more open to them and try and work with them in a skillful way. This requires more awareness and wisdom than just willpower and forcing it. So hopefully you can appreciate that approach, even though maybe on this short time, maybe you don't notice any dramatic changes, but especially in the long term. And this is what Ajahn Chah was really emphasizing. I went to Thailand just to do a short meditation retreat and have my awakening experience and go back to normal again. Well, not normal, because I was enlightened too. I wanted my normal life and enlightenment too, you see. That's why it didn't work. Then I would be called schizophrenic and enlightened neurotic, you know. But what Ajahn Chah was really emphasizing was the spiritual practice as a way of life. And it took me some time to really appreciate that, but it's how to live this teaching, what the Buddha was teaching too. You know, it's a way of life. It's not just a technique, a short-term technique to solve a few ego problems, because we still got our ego there in the end anyway. You know, so we just sort of sort out a few ego problems, and it'll come back with more problems later. You know. But as a way of life, it's actually learning to relate to this ego in a more friendly, wise way. Not to try and get rid of it, or conquer it, or transcend it, but to learn to work with it with wisdom now. We need our ego. Don't have an ego, you're psychotic, so watch out. But it's better to have a more awakened ego than an ignorant one. So more beneficial for ourselves and for the rest of the world too. So, so I think I should pause there this evening, and I don't want to keep you up too late. So we have an early morning, I think.
Those who want to wake up in early.
Oh yeah, if you want to wake up early, it is an early morning. Yeah. Or some people have traveled a long way through the Friday evening rush hour traffic, which I did yesterday. So I know how disorientating it can be. So for those who want to continue with your practice, it goes on, it's open-ended, so there's no end to it.
Yes, right, you can meditate all night.
You can meditate all night if you want, I mean. till the solar power goes out. And then tomorrow morning, 5 o'clock, is there bells, or people have to...
No bells, Ajahn. No. Chanting at 6, for those who are interested. So.
Mm-hmm. And waking up at 5 o'clock, you know, the first one up gets to use the toilet first, you see. That's a little incentive. You know. Otherwise, you got to stand in a queue and get bitten by mosquitoes. So I think I should pause there this evening.
Yes.